In the coming week, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro faces COVID-19 corruption charges. Haitians face political uncertainty in the wake of a presidential assassination. In China, EU talks heat up in Brussels. It's July 8th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Lindsay.
And I'm Shannon O'Neill, sitting in for Bob McMahon.
Shannon is the Vice President, Deputy Director of Studies, and Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies at CFR. Shannon, it's a pleasure to have you back on The World Next Week.
It's always great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Shannon, let's begin by talking about a country you know a lot about, Brazil. More than 525,000 Brazilians have died from COVID, making Brazil one of the hardest hit countries in the world. But Brazil's problems don't stop there. Brazilian President Bolsonaro now faces corruption charges, which is putting his presidency and his re-election bid in potential peril. Can you sort of fill us in about Brazil's current political crisis?
Well, Jair Bolsonaro has been part of this wave of authoritarian leading populists around the world. So he's someone who has come out with fairly conservative social views. He's been quite provocative on social media. And like many of his counterparts around the world, he has, over the last year and a half, downplayed the severity of COVID. And that has had real consequences on the ground in Brazil. Brazil is one of the countries hit hardest by COVID, and the pandemic rages on there. In fact, last week they hit record high number of cases, so it continues to be a strong issue. What he's in hot water for right now is there have been ongoing congressional investigations into the handling of COVID. We have seen just over the last week or so, someone from the health official and ministry come out with allegations that there was trying to illegally purchase particular vaccines, that there's corruption involved, and this is starting to reach throughout his administration.
How popular is Bolsonaro with Brazilians? Is he riding high in the polls, or is he already sort of taken on water because of the COVID-19 crisis in Brazil?
He's definitely taken on water. And this really, the last few weeks or last month or so, you've seen a real decline in his support. So now the vast majority of Brazilians are no longer supporting him. And a lot of the establishment business is looking elsewhere for someone to back. And interestingly, also in this time frame, his political rival, and some would say his nemesis, Lula, who's a former president, he had been convicted by courts of corruption associated with a piece of real estate. That conviction was overturned. So he is again allowed to run for political office, and it looks like he will run for the presidency in 2022. So where a year ago Bolsonaro looked pretty strong and maybe would easily sail into a re-election in the year to come, now it looks much more uncertain. And in fact, recent polls show Lula could potentially win in the first round of the election, which is something for Brazil. So it's still a long way away from, you know, October 2022, but the political dynamics have changed there pretty significantly.
Okay, but we're assuming at this point that Bolsonaro makes it to that election, but there are really two issues here. One is he potentially could be impeached. There's some history of that in Brazilian politics. So what do you think the chances are that the Brazilian Congress moves to oust Bolsonaro?
There is a history of that. And Dilma Rousseff, who was the elected president before him, there was an interim president, she was impeached. So there definitely is that history. And there's a president from the 1990s. So they have a track record of that. You know, that's the real question. I think it's in the end, Bolsonaro will probably hang on to next year. You know, Brazilians, it's a lot to impeach your president and upset the system during a time, and particularly a time where they're still facing a huge health crisis as well as some economic challenges. He has reached out to the larger center a lot with patronage and other ways of trying to draw people in so that he doesn't get impeached. But you definitely have seen a renewed momentum against Bolsonaro, against his government, some calling for impeachment. But I think what, in the end, if I had to bet, he'll hang on, but his re-election prospects look much less strong than they did just a few months ago. So, and what we do see is really political policy paralysis. So Bolsonaro came in with a huge agenda to do pension reform and tax reform and regulatory reform and all kinds of things that particularly outside observers and investors wanted. And now, you know, that whole agenda is really frozen as they fight it out for his political survival, basically.
Okay, Shannon, the second thing I've heard that may sort of upset our assumptions that we're going to see Bolsonaro face off against Lula in October 2022 is that Bolsonaro in recent days has been talking about how he might not run for election under the current voting system. Can you sort of explain to us what that's all about?
Well, Bolsonaro has followed his who he sees as a friend and compatriot in Donald Trump in some of his moves in terms of vis-a-vis the political system. So he is one of the only international leaders that has praised what happened in the United States on January 6th, this idea of a citizen revolt. And he's framed it in patriotic terms. And he's talked a bit about that there is fraud in elections, that the Brazilian system doesn't work. A lot of the rhetoric we've heard here in the United States coming from various Republicans and the Donald Trump campaign or group. So we're hearing a bit of parallel down there. And so this idea that, would he run because he doesn't feel like he'll get a fair shake? And, really interesting part, Bolsonaro ties himself very closely to the military in Brazil. He was a military officer, though he was pushed out of the military for some bad behavior at one point. But he sees himself, he ties himself to that. He's brought in many military officers into cabinet positions and the like, more than any other democratically elected leader in Brazil. And I think there's a real question here where the military will go. Much of the military, including the vice president, who is a retired military officer, have said that they will stand by Brazil's constitution, that they will hold elections. So we're not seeing it from that side of things yet, nor from the establishment of Brazil. They want to uphold Brazil's institution. And I would say it's a lot of political turmoil. It's going to make things difficult for Brazil. It's going to slow their economic recovery. It's going to slow their ability to deal with the pandemic. But overall, you have a president who's pretty authoritarian leaning, who is a populist. And for now, Brazil's institutions are really holding. So whether the Supreme Court, the Congress, the others, they're checking some of these tendencies. So he's talking a big game, but the reality so far, at least, is not going anywhere, I would say.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those institutions holding. And I note that you mentioned that the Brazilian military has said it intends to respect the Constitution. But obviously, there's a history there of the military intervening in politics. Brazil was a military dictatorship, from 1964 to the mid-1980s. Do you think that the notion of civilian control of the military or an apolitical military has really taken hold in Brazil?
I do think the military prefers to stay in its professional role and in its lane. And that is something Bolsonaro is trying to pull it into politics, but it's very recalcitrant to get back in. And in part, there are still memories of that time and the backlash that they faced. And then in the 1990s, civilian governments cut their budgets and reduced some of their ability to operate. And they also saw that it's better not to take that space in politics, given the polarization and the challenges and, the human rights abuses and things that many within the military were accused of during that time. And so I see actually a military that's very recalcitrant to jump in. I see an overall establishment in Brazil that doesn't want the military to arbitrate, but I do see a president and his inner circle who are hoping to use that to push through their agenda and potentially keep themselves in power. So right now, I do think the military, above all the institutions, is behaving democratically, is following those rules. And the vice president in particular, who is a military officer, has come out many times and staked a position that is an apolitical position for the military, sort of representing them. Though he, of course, is the vice president, so he's taken a political post. But overall, as I watch Brazil, I do think what we've seen actually is under stress, an incredible stress, economic recession, a pandemic that's hit the country harder than almost any other country in the world, a president and his inner circle that have pushed, and tried to erode checks and balances and the like, big corruption cases that, in terms of money moving around in gray ways, if not, legal ways, that the institutions are holding. And you're seeing a court system that is investigating many of these cases, including those involving the Bolsonaro family members. You're seeing a Congress that actually has picked up, until just recently, the legislative agenda and is pushing through these issues. It's not as led by the president and his inner circle as much as members of Congress. And you're seeing a Congress, as we've seen over these last few weeks, with all these explosive revelations that are leading hearings into the behavior of members of the executive branch and the administration. So as we look around the world and, many of these populist leaders that have looked to erode democratic checks and balances, Brazil's democratic system seems to be pushing back in what I would say is good ways for the long-term political management of that nation.
Well, let's hope that continues, because obviously Brazil's turn to democracy was important, not just for Brazilians, but for the rest of Latin America. It was quite significant and really sort of, I think, moved the needle in the region.
It is. It's the biggest economy in the region, and it has been one to demonstrate and to support democracies in other nations. And particularly when they have faltered at various moments, the Brazilian government has stepped in and pushed nations like Paraguay and others at critical moments to maintain or preserve their democracy when there were some forces who were against it.
We'll have you back on the show on the eve of the election to give us a lay of the land.
Well, we will see if it's Bolsonaro versus Lula or, you know, it's a long time until October 2022. So we will see who is in the running and where everything stands. But, you know, speaking of democracies and fragility of democracy in the region, Jim, let's turn to a breaking story. And this is the news that is coming out of Haiti. And just yesterday morning, the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated in the bedroom of his home. And his wife was with him and was in critical situation as well. And then after this gunfire erupted throughout the whole Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, we've seen the Haitian authorities say that they have killed 4 people as well as captured 2 others who may be or are likely associated with the assassination. We've seen the Haitian interim prime minister, Claude Joseph, has called on the international community to help them and to launch an investigation. And he's also called for the United Nations to hold a Security Council meeting. So talk a little bit about this tragedy that's unfolding so close here to the United States.
Well, Shannon, all discussions about breaking news stories have to begin with the caveat that there's a lot we probably don't know, and this is a fluid story, and the details could change. I mean, it is clear that President Moïse was assassinated, his wife was wounded, apparently she has been flown to Fort Lauderdale for treatment. The details of the assassination remain sketchy. Who was behind it, we don't know. A group described as well-trained professional commandos who were supposedly speaking a mix of Spanish in English, in identifying themselves as DEA agents, attacked the president's home. The fact that the commandos were supposedly speaking Spanish and English is significant because Haiti is a country in which the official languages are French and Creole. As you mentioned, the Haitian police say they have killed 4 of the assassins, arrested 2 of them, and they have described the assassins as foreigners. We know nothing more about it than that. And there will no doubt have to be investigations as to who was behind the plot. And obviously, at this point, you could speculate. I'm not sure how much that gets you. The reality is that Haiti has been in a slow-moving crisis for the last year and a half, and now it may, in some sense, see that crisis really accelerate. Moïse was ruling by decree since January of 2020. That's when he dissolved the parliament. In theory, the interim president is Claude Joseph, as you mentioned, but it's not clear that he's actually in charge because he was supposed to step down as the interim prime minister on Monday following Moïse's appointment of a neurosurgeon named Ariel Henry to be Haiti's new prime minister. So there's a bit of confusion going on here. All of this is taking place against the backdrop of escalating gang violence across the country. Keep in mind, Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. It is also dealing with a new surge of COVID, not surprisingly, given how poor Haiti is. It really lacks the health infrastructure to deal with a resurgent COVID crisis. So it has that problem. So the question becomes, where is Haiti going to go? And will other countries, most notably the United States, step in any fashion to help the Haitians at this moment of, I think, tremendous peril?
As you look at that, whether the United States or other nations or the UN Security Council, as the current interim prime minister has hoped for, what is it that they could do in this situation? What are the scenarios or what are the options that the international community has to help this incredibly fraught situation?
Well, the options range from doing absolutely nothing to a full-fledged intervention. And we have seen everything along that spectrum over the last 100 years or so in Haiti. I will note that President Biden has called the assassination of President Moïse as a heinous crime. He has also said that the United States intends to work for a safe and secure Haiti. But he's also said the United States needs to know a lot more. And I think if you are working the Haiti desk in the U.S. State Department, or you're working on the NSC staff and you're responsible for Latin America, you're scrambling right now, number one, just to understand the facts. I mean, you know the president of Haiti has been killed, but you don't know much beyond that. And here's where you're trying to sort of sort between facts in fiction, rumor in reality, and that can be really difficult. Now, obviously, from a meta position, the Biden administration has very little interest in becoming deeply enmeshed in Haiti. Again, part of what the Biden administration has been trying to do since it came to office is to reduce the number of overseas military engagements the United States has. And we haven't reached the point in which sending in U.S. troops is likely to be on the table. I'll also note in a bit of historical irony that at the end of this month, July 28th, will mark the 105th anniversary of the U.S. military intervention in Haiti, prompted by the assassination of another Haitian president, and that U.S. occupation lasted for 19 years. Senator Biden, as long before he became President Biden, suggested that the United States has minimal interest in Haiti, so we have to take that into account. But the reality is the situation on the ground in Haiti could escalate. I think one thing is likely is you will see some kind of fact-finding mission established to do investigation on the facts on the ground. But beyond that, I think a lot of things are up in the air.
Well, and we've also seen the United States may not think they have a huge interest in Haiti, but in the past when we've seen turmoil in the 1990s in terms of the leadership of Haiti and leaders being exiled, we also saw a huge wave of migrants come from Haiti. And that is something the Biden administration is dealing with from other regions of the world. And that is something, too, the desk at the NSC must be thinking about.
Oh, certainly. I mean, right now, there's something on the order of 700,000 Haitians in the United States. I believe the Biden administration not too long ago reinstated the provision that allowed Haitians to remain in the country. It was a provision that the Trump administration had ended, which would have required Haitians here under hardship to go back to Haiti. And I will note the United States has a long and complicated relationship with Haiti, going back to its founding, the beginning of the 19th century, when the Haitians overthrew French rule. The United States chose not to recognize Haiti as an independent nation, going all the way through the 1990s, where U.S. forces went to Haiti for a time. And obviously, I think it was 2010, the absolutely horrific earthquake that devastated Haiti. So the United States does have a longstanding interest. The question is, how will the Biden administration choose to exercise its policy response to that crisis? I think right now, there are some people in the NSC, in the Defense Department, and in the State Department who are going to be working this weekend trying to figure out, A, what's happened, B, what are our choices in terms of a country, in terms of responding. Right now, it has mostly been the administration saying it's horrified by what has happened and it will help, but the details of what that help will be still have to be sketched out.
I'm sure there's some folks in New York at the UN also working this weekend as well. And, you know, Haiti has been a place of peacekeeping troops in the past. The Brazilians were big parts of that, as well as other Latin Americans. And so perhaps that's also on the table. The Biden administration is thinking about that bigger effort coming from the Western Hemisphere or elsewhere.
Shannon, let's switch gears now and talk about the upcoming EU Foreign Affairs Council and the Eurogroup of EU finance ministers meeting in Brussels. China is set to top the agenda at both meetings as Europeans try to come to agreement on Europe's complicated and conflicted relationship with China. Can you fill us in on the issues that EU leaders are grappling with?
Yeah, it's going to be an important week in Brussels for all these, the foreign affairs side and the finance side. There are some internal EU issues on the table, so they'll be talking about the euro bonds that are being admitted to try to get the recovery going in Europe. There's going to be a lot of talk of taxes, especially among the finance ministers, digital taxes and global alternative minimum taxes and carbon border adjustment taxes and lots of ideas that are out there. But a real center of both these meetings is going to be China and what EU-China relations looks like going forward. And Europe has been changing a bit. One, there's a changing perceptions of China and some of the friendliness or the upside optimism that is there has faded. And there's a sense of it becoming more of a strategic rival for many of these countries. But we also see a Europe that is both dependent on China in terms of exports in the more, you know, advanced industrial economies, the Germanys and the Frances who send many of their exports there or operate within China. And then you see many of the Eastern European countries dependent on foreign direct investment from China and coming. So there's a balance here. And the other balance that they're struggling with is Europe has this sense of what they call strategic autonomy. They want to be separate from the United States. They want to be separate from China. They want to have their own road to go ahead. So they don't want to align too closely with the increasingly combative approach that the United States is taking to China. But Europe, and especially Brussels, the EU, also sees itself as a leader or even the leader on protecting global democratic values, for upholding human rights, for pushing for the environment and stopping climate change. So they see themselves in that role too. And China, obviously, in some of these cases, there's tensions there as we see what's been happening with the Uyghurs and others. So all of this will be up for discussion as the finance ministers and these foreign affairs officials meet. And, you know, when they come out the other side, there probably won't be a lot of definition, but they will be deep conversations into how to approach China going forward.
I have to ask, Shannon, do you think it's realistic for the Europeans to carve this path of strategic autonomy in which they operate independently of the United States as this autonomous actor in world politics, but still manage somehow to stand up for the values and their economic interests against China? Or is this happy talk? And the reality is that the nature of the dynamics is that the Europeans are going to have to choose, and the sooner they choose, the better off they'll be.
So the Europeans have seen in the nitty-gritty technical side, they have had some wins, let's say, in shaping the agenda on their own. The policy wonks in Brussels like to talk about what they call the Brussels effect, which is they set out regulations that are set for Europe in terms of food safety standards or technology standards and the like. And then those have been adopted often globally because companies don't want to remake their cars or remake the way they do things. They want to sell into the European market and they're not going to have separate products for other markets. So they think they have some track record in that side. And I think on the technical side, they often do. There's some space there. But when you get to these bigger geopolitical issues and battles, frankly, or stances, it's hard for me to see how the Europeans can carve out some sort of third way that's between where the US and China will be. And we will see where they end up. But in the end, I think they will come on many issues to side with the United States, because especially on the political side, on the human rights side, on the environmental side, on these things, there's a lot more in common with the current US administration, at least, and both European countries on their own, as well as the European government in Brussels.
I'm not so sure the Brussels effect is going to be as powerful as many of the technocrats in Brussels think. It is true it has had that impact in the past, but my sense is, from everything coming out of Beijing, that Beijing intends to set those standards in ways that advantage Chinese businesses. And in that sense, it is a zero-sum competition. Am I wrong in that?
That's definitely true. There's the Beijing effect that's happening around the world. And China has, over the last decade, made lots of inroads into these very technical international bodies that decide the specifications on each, IP protocol for the internet and all kinds of other electronic and other kinds of standards. And they have done it in the way to lean towards their companies. And while these are very technocratic, wonky bodies, they really matter because it decides whose patents and who gets the royalties and what kinds of, the way things are designed and what fits into each other, what's interoperability in terms of, your blender and your toaster and then all the AI that's down the road. So there's all these kinds of things that are happening. And the Chinese have been very forward leaning in getting their people in there and writing the papers that will set the discussions and that will lean in their favor. And I would say we're just seeing in recent months, frankly, here in the United States, but in Europe, perhaps a little bit longer, a little bit before, we're starting to see these countries re-engage and push a more Western view there, but also one that's a little bit more open to US and European standards. So while this Brussels effect, I think, worked for a while and was something in the 90s, the early 2000s was a real thing, now you have a China who's very focused on these things. So that is a next battleground. It's sort of a quiet battleground of technical papers and different kinds of interactions between scientists and industry specialists, but it is somewhere where you are seeing a lot of back and forth. And frankly, it is somewhere where we will do much better in setting a broader standard if the Europeans and the United States, as well as some other nations, Japan and others, come together, South Korea, particularly on the electronic side, if they come together as more of a united front.
Okay, I'm going to use that phrase, Beijing effect, going forward. Just want you to know I will properly credit you. But there's another aspect of this tension for the Europeans that I'm really interested in getting your thoughts on. And that has to do with Chinese investment, particularly investment coming through the so-called Belt and Road Initiative. And here I should do a shout out to the Council's excellent task force report on the Belt and Road Initiative. People can find it at CFR.org. But one of the issues that has divided Europeans is the wisdom of allowing China to come in and invest heavily in their countries. And I will note the Chinese have made big investments in ports in Greece. They have also invested heavily in Montenegro. I believe they helped the Montenegrins build a massive highway, which apparently goes nowhere and isn't finished, and the Montenegrins may not be able to pay for, which has raised the alarms in other European capitals. How do you think about these issues, Shannon?
Well, I think the souring on Chinese investment that you've seen across Europe is sort of twofold. So one side is this basic infrastructure, the ports and the highways and the like, and many countries embraced them and they were looking for investment, particularly Eastern European countries, those that needed infrastructure and had sort of lagged on that side. And there, you know, some are quite happy with their investment. Others, like the Montenegrins, as you say, there's a highway to nowhere and didn't really employ local people. And now they're on the docket to pay for it or to service that debt. You have also seen in the last number of years, an increasing worry about the Chinese coming in a more technological way and coming in and buying companies that have intellectual property and the like. So there's a big case in Germany that happened a number of years back where the Chinese came in and bought a robotics company that then all of a sudden the national security interests in Germany were very concerned about. Right now, there's a case in the UK, which we all know is no longer part of the EU, but is a larger Europe, where the Chinese have bought the largest semiconductor company in the UK. And now the government has just said they're going to review that purchase and see if they think it meets their national standards. So I think we have sort of two levels here of growing concern in Europe about Chinese investment, whether they control the physical infrastructure and not allow the free movement of goods or people or other things, and if that is a challenge. And then also, will they come in and buy some of the more advanced AI, quantum computing, come in and control some of those semiconductors, come in and control some of those aspects that nations all around the world, including the Chinese, see as the way to win sort of the technological jump and transition that is to come. And you see Brussels, the European Union and others starting to talk more about how do we set up structures to keep out Chinese or other actors from what we will deem national champions. And we've also seen over the last couple of years, governments standing up, the French stopping the Chinese from buying people, the Germans as well. So I think that is a trend that we are going to see more and more in Europe. And in some ways, it's catching up with the United States that has been shutting out similar types of Chinese foreign direct investment using CFIUS, which is a body in the U.S. government that reviews these kinds of investments and decides whether or not they're for national security. And increasingly in the United States, CFIUS decides that no, the Chinese cannot come into these various sectors. And I think we're going to start seeing that more and more across Europe, a similar turning away of some of this investment.
Well, I suspect that when German Chancellor Angela Merkel shows up at the White House next week to meet with President Biden as part of what I assume is her valedictory tour after four terms as Chancellor of Germany, that she's going to hear a lot from President Biden on just this score, that the Germans and the Europeans more broadly won't be able to have their cake and eat it too with China, that China does present a threat economically as well as to values, and to urge the Germans to take a stronger stand on this. But this is going to be a continuing issue in which I think they're going to be at times alignment between Washington and Europe and other times real divisions and also divisions in Europe itself.
That's definitely going to be the case. And so I think you will, this strategic autonomy idea that we don't want to be so closely aligned with the United States because European nations have their own interests. I also think you may see as we go forward divisions in the approach, or at least the public approach of individual European nations. So you have Merkel and Macron, the president of France, talking with Xi and talking about making, you know, ties closer and opening up for business from France and Germany, protecting their own companies. And then you will see in Brussels at the EU, the technocrats take a harder line. So you may have a little bit of a good cop, bad cop happening in Europe as presidents of individual countries or heads of state of individual countries try to protect their companies in terms of Chinese pushback. But as you say, it's going to be an ongoing discussion, sometimes close and sometimes a bit more tense between the United States and Europe as they navigate what to do with China going forward.
It's a big issue that has legs and we'll be talking about for quite a while to come.
Indeed. Well, Jim, I think it's time to pivot. And it's time to discuss our audience figure of the week. And this is where listeners can vote on or tweet at us at CFR_org. So this week, Jim, what has our audience selected?
Shannon, our audience opted for 1,000 Afghan soldiers flee. And I think the reason that people pick this as the figure of the week is to touch on a broader concern about the looming collapse of the Afghan government in the wake of the U.S. military withdrawal. And trends since President Biden announced that all U.S. forces will be out by September 11th have been pretty dire in Afghanistan. I should note that the U.S. forces are likely to be out well before the September 11th deadline. The United States just left Bagram Air Force Base, which I believe is north of Kabul, this week, did so in the middle of the night and didn't inform the Afghans until after it was over. The specific story that the audience selected had to do with Afghan soldiers in the northeastern part of the country country near the border with Tajikistan, in essence, seeing the oncoming Taliban forces in crossing the border. But that's just one story of many. Just before we get on to record this podcast, I saw a story, I believe in the Washington Post, about Afghan soldiers in the northwestern part of the country trying to get into Uzbekistan with the approach of the Taliban. Taliban have really taken over a very large chunk of rural parts of Afghanistan. They're still operating outside of the major cities for the most part. In many parts of Afghanistan, when the Taliban have come in, they have done so relatively peacefully. That is, there have been negotiations going on between Taliban leaders and local warlords, tribal leaders, and in essence, people looking around and saying, the Afghan government is not going to be able to help us, so it's better for us to cut a deal with the Taliban. I think the big question we have is, what is going to happen in the more urban portions of Afghanistan? Are you going to see pitch battle, something like take us back to what it was when the Taliban came to power in the early 1990s? And again, there's been a real split among experts about how a U.S. withdrawal is likely to play out. People who were skeptical of the Biden decision have argued all along that you're going to see a spread of the Taliban, large violence, they'll take over the country, and much of what the United States fought for over the past 20 years will go away, with other experts saying, no, the Afghan government will be more dynamic than that. It'll be able to preserve in the major cities, or that other ethnic groups in Afghanistan will rally together because they're opposed to the Taliban, potentially with help from outside powers. I would say so far, the early trends all sort of suggest that the former, more pessimistic school of thought looks to be right. But of course, it hasn't totally played out.
Now, it seems there's a question about, is this a different Taliban than the one that came in the 1990s, more open to a broader coalition government down the road or not, and has to play out? What's been happening? There has been a big discussion here in the United States about the Afghans that have helped the Americans over these last 20 years. And what is happening with those Afghans and their ability to get here to the United States?
Well, there has been some movement on this front, and you're quite right, Shannon. For many Americans who served in Afghanistan, it is a point of pride to them that they take care of their own, that we should do something for the tens of thousands of Afghans who worked as interpreters, translators, cooks, security guards, and the rest. The fear being that if the Taliban do come to power, they're likely to be killed or imprisoned, tortured, and the like. The Biden administration has taken steps in the last few days to say that the United States will set up a process for Afghans to come to the United States. But I think initially what is going to happen is those Afghans will have to go to another country before they can come to the United States. And as you know, Shannon, because you work this issue a lot in the context of Latin America, immigration of all sorts is a very complicated, controversial issue which can motivate people. So we'll see how all of this plays out, to what extent the Biden administration can follow through on what it says it is going to do, what the bureaucratic capacity is to handle tens of thousands of people coming through. Not too hard to imagine you're going to see claims that you're going to have people taking advantage of this program coming in who are bent on doing harm to Americans. So this is a big issue to keep our eyes on.
Definitely. And last question on this, as you think about other powers that might move in as the United States pulls out, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, the Russians obviously have a long history there that didn't go particularly well for them. There's a little PTSD, I would imagine, within that government. But what about the Chinese, which also share a border with Afghanistan?
I don't know if any of the countries that surround Afghanistan are interested in putting their own troops on the ground. And I would think that if you were a leader in China or Russia or Iran, you would consult history, and it's a pretty dismal record for outside powers that commit their own forces to Afghanistan. But obviously, you don't have to send your own forces, and you can act through proxy forces. And I think there have been a lot of calculations that the outside powers, and I think China, Russia, and Iran are the most significant. I guess you could also say Pakistan, which in many ways has been sort of playing a dual game with the Taliban. But obviously, outside powers don't need to send troops into Afghanistan to influence what is happening on the ground there. And I suspect all those countries will be trying to use proxy actors to protect their interests. The Chinese obviously are worried about radical Islamic groups sort of crossing the border. China does share a very small border with Afghanistan. The Russians are worried about the potential to destabilize Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Iranians are greatly worried about what's going to happen on their border, but they also have a lot of co-religionists, fellow Shia, who are in great danger from the Taliban because of the Taliban's very intolerant version of Islam. So even if the Taliban do come to power, the story's not going to end there. I think there'll be a lot of countries intervening, if I can use that term, in the affairs of Afghanistan, and they will have a lot of willing takers among Afghanistans. Again, Afghanistan is a place that has numerous ethnic divisions, religious divisions as well, and a strong history of a regional autonomy. And that is likely to continue even if the Taliban come back into power. Again, we look back in the 1990s, while the Taliban took over much of the country, it did not take over all of the country in particular. It was unable to subdue the so-called Northern Alliance.
A story I'm sure we'll be watching going forward again.
Oh, I think this is going to have a lot of political salience in the United States, because again, there are a number of people who are quite critical of President Biden for his decision. Many of those people Republicans, but also a fair number of Democrats who are also critical of the decision to withdraw entirely.
Definitely. Well, Jim, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories that you should keep your eye on. As mentioned, German Chancellor Angela Merkel visits President Biden in the White House. Yitzhak Herzog takes office as the new president of Israel. And the G20 Women 20 Summit takes place in Rome.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge, Chloe Malvay, Leila Marhamati, and Michael Kohler for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Shannon O'Neill saying goodbye.
This is Jim Lindsay saying so long.